This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Good evening. Hi. I'm Rachel Blau Duplessis, and I have the pleasure and honor of introducing Barrett Watton again after his reading at Temple the other night. As a scholar, poet, editor, art curator, and cultural critic, Barrett Watton is an exemplary poet-critic and one of the premier persons whom one might currently group under this rubric. Whether in poetry or literary criticism, Watton repeatedly and efficiently proposes frame-breaking analyses and activities. He undertakes these poetic and critical tasks with a fertile imagination and set of allusions across the whole 20th century and a subtle understanding of the various poetics of European and American avant-gardes and the necessities of various key social movements. Some of his books, and I think they are for sale in the back, which you should check out, are Progress / Under Erasure, two books grouped under the same title, or under that title, first published in 1985, but recently republished, Bad History and Frame, 1971 to 1990. These are important and uncompromising works, major interventions in how we think about the terms and assumptions of poetry, from issues of the writing subject and subjectivity to the tones and materials of poetry, and to an insistence that poetry is a form of knowledge production. Where do you put your alienation? What is the utopian horizon possible? Why resist affirmative findings with the poetics of negativity? These are all questions that Watton takes up and drives forward. One might say of his poetic works what he has said of Russian poet Arkady Dragomashenko's work. Here, a poetics of memory is fractured and refigured by means of a relentless epistemological critique toward a more complicated horizon. Watton is also one of the leading intellectuals in cultural studies, with a demanding, incisive, and crucial book in the field of, quote, new modernist studies, The Constructivist Moment, From Material Text to Cultural Poetics. This book won the René Wellick Prize in 2004 from the Comparative Literature Association. Watton locates moments when rupture, refusal, or resistance give rise to a horizon of possibility. This major book is, among other things, eloquent and moving, even as it is dense and generative. Personally and intellectually, Watton is lucid, wide-ranging, challenging, and generous, mightily generous, as well as mighty, in his willingness and patience pedagogically to engage and explore his ideas with pertinacity and care. He's also recently spearheaded the writing of a collective autobiography of language poetries in San Francisco in a recent and forthcoming series also available called The Grand Piano. He teaches literature and poetics at Wayne State in Detroit. I'm really happy to welcome Barrett Watton to Slot.
Okay, mic?
You're on.
I'm on? Yeah, okay, good. Well, thank you, Rachel, and I particularly want to thank you for the occasion of the visit to Temple. It's been, you know, nonstop, as you know, celebrations and talk. And Aaron, for your exceptional curatorial chops, figuring out exactly how find the intersection of Slouts' programming and the work that I'm bringing here. So I'm really delighted for the occasion to get this off my chest, this thing, this negativity that I've been concerned with. My title basically draws from Nietzsche's important work on the advantage and disadvantages of history for life, and I always think of that for life as a kind of pitch that Nietzsche is kind of throwing at you. And so this is on the advantages and disadvantages of negativity for life. And it draws on the discussion in the constructivist moment of the Poetics of Negativity, chapter 6 in the book, Negative Examples. And in that chapter, basically, I talk about the number of different ways one might think of different accounts of the negative, moving rather quickly away from logical negation and through psychoanalytic notions, and then playing around between theorists. I use Heidegger, Foucault, and Zizek in that chapter. And one of the things I'm trying to do is get away from an old account of the avant-garde, basically maybe a dialectical one, where the avant-garde is a negative move, and then the next thing that happens is sublation into, you know, institutions or a loss of force, or so, you know, the avant-garde is no longer negative. Adorno, of course, you know, has the major argument that moves away from that position. So it's a Poetics of the Avant-Garde seen through the vicissitudes of the negative, where there isn't one size all fitting, one size fits all negative. So here's the piece. On one epigraph, on 1 May 1975, I attended a meeting of a communist organization, the Grand Piano, Section 2, Part 1. There is no one-size-fits-all negativity that derives from either logical or determinate negation. Negativity has more than the single attribute of the logical operation of negation performed by the particle not. Negativity, as it occurs in the field, so to speak, with the radical forms and interventions of the avant-garde, partakes of numerous distinct modes, even as its final horizon, a denial of positivity, locates each instance as a potential form of critique, the constructivist moment. Negativity has a bad reputation, and it is only getting worse. Negativity resents this and thinks that, of all the non-concepts that have been transformative for both cultural politics and radical poetics, it should be best regarded. Negativity wants recognition for the work it has been doing in its negative way, including its questioning of itself. Negativity is thus anxious and cannot get past the fact of its own anxiety to the extent that it can only imagine its own destruction as a consequence of its inquiry into itself. It is through this self-destroying inquiry that negativity accedes to the form of that which it is not, into the form of the object that survives it. This object is the work of art, the ghost of negativity. It is precisely in negativity's leaving the scene of its own destruction in the work of art that it has its political effect. Here, negativity calls into question all false positives of the relation of the work to that from which it is formed, the positive relations of the world, of the positive relations of the world into which the work extends its negativity. Along the via negativa of false positivity, bombs explode and the rescue squad is shrouded in darkness. Sniper fire flares across the road. Negativity observes this terrible state of affairs. It stands back and assesses the situation and submits its report negatively. It cannot tolerate what it has witnessed. It can only represent the form of events in the manner of its rejection of them, thus representing the reason they occurred in its reversal of the positivity of their effects. It thus accedes to a more general level, a complete and total rejection of what is undertaken in its name. Negativity wants to push the false constructions based on inadequate positivity back into darkness, and I am here to assist in that task. If there is a problem with negativity in aesthetics and politics, it is good to recall the cultural history of the term and its baleful opposite, positivity, that got us to that point. It is precisely the cultural logic of the negative in relation to false positivity that I want to bring into relation with the aesthetic. A moment in Hegel's biography clarifies his disclosure of the negative in terms of the strictly cultural meanings of positivity in an early incomplete project called The Positivity of Christian Religion. Quote, for Hegel, his biographer writes, positive religion, on analogy to positive as opposed to natural law, is any religion and its associated doctrines whose normative force depends on there being the established religion of a people. Positivity, thus, in law and in religion, is that which relies on the dictates of authority instead of those dictates that come from thinking for oneself. Religion, as ideology, is connected to the form of the state. In Germany, states. There are many different state formations of religion. And Hegel's perception of this, a direct one of the nature of religious discourse, as experienced in the cultural confines of German provincial life, led directly to his transposition of religion into spirit through the work of the negative. Quote, what had been the ideal of elevation to the infinite in love increasingly became a positive religion based on the authority of a teacher and on a belief in a God who became increasingly and necessarily conceived not as an object of love, but merely as a master who commands. For his biographer again, therefore to be gone beyond. In the modern period, the positivity of state formations as ideology, as we know, was relocated in consumer society by the Frankfurt School, even as the necessity of the negative remains. The ghost of authoritarianism in Hegel's transposition of religion also reemerged as Theodore Adorno and co-authors' account of the authoritarian personality and its construction out of deformed ideological strands, all of which equally ideological. While the bedrock positivity that subtends this system are the false positives of science, against which Adorno would continue to level his massive critique of negative dialectics. For art, Adorno's imperative was to defer any moment movement toward the positive by keeping the formal logics of negativity in play, while for other strands of critical theory, particularly Marcuse's, the cultural entailments of positive ideology must be constantly resisted in and as affirmative culture. The current recovery of Adorno's critical theory needs to take better account of these cultural logics of the negative in their original but certainly not final inscriptions as spirit or form. This is the site for my re-engagement of the negative in the movement from aesthetic form to cultural logic in undermining false positives. It is, of course, the stultifying seizure of art and politics by false positivity that most concerns us now. The moment of construction can only be one of radical negativity. But negativity in what sense? If there is no one-size-fits-all account of the negative, how do we negotiate the plurality of the negative to find a proper vehicle for agency? So I'm going to discuss this problem of the negativity and the aesthetic in three different genres. And the first is poetry, followed by music, followed by art. And so we'll go to poetry. I want to compare two moments of the negative in the recent public life or even future public life of experimental poetry, not to characterize one as bad and repressive and the other as good and constructive, as if the continuing vicissitudes of the negative were so easily assigned values. The first comes in the support for a moment associated with the current turn to sound, as one of the directions formerly innovative poetics may take, and also a ground it seeks. Marjorie Perloff positions this turn to sound as part of her initiative to return poetry and poetics to the center of attention at the upcoming meeting of the MLA between two contrasting negatives, roughly aesthetic and cultural, after the discussion above. In aesthetic terms, Perloff rightly notes that after the rejection of formalism of the Anglo-American variety, thematic readings of poetry have been valorized over aesthetic, more currently material and affective ones. The aesthetic here has a special relation to what is presented to the senses. For poetry, what Roman Jakobson called the sound shape of language. This in turn points to the specificity of poetry in and as the materiality of its language, opening the way to a focus on translation between languages as an important area of scholarship. The language school's contribution has been central here in radically foregrounding both oral and visual materiality. But it is also possible to discern a moment of positivity in this turn that brings our radical intervention in line with more ancient, even formalist, approaches such as Brooks and Warren's Understanding Poetry, where, as many of us were taught, the interrelation of sound and meaning just is the aesthetic. Unlinking this false positivity, another axis of the negative is developed in Perloff's claim that, in the return to merely thematic readings, quote, poetry is studied as a symptom of anxieties, inequities, or cultural displacements of one sort or another. Here, the ideological identification of sound and meaning is unlinked by splitting them and relegating meaning to the contested terrain of the cultural. The Mandarin tone one hears in Of One Sort or Another, a kind of dismissal that might be more proper to an account of the great unwashed from the rhetoric of the House of Lords, has a precise register in cultural politics. Discourses of the other, of race, class, and gender, of the cultural displacements of immigration and war, of our global disequilibrium. Even as a poetry may have a politics in and of sound, the exclusion of cultural meanings as merely thematic, and again I'll read the quote, poetry is studied by cultural studies as a symptom of anxieties, inequities, or cultural displacements of one sort or another. The exclusion of cultural meanings as merely thematic and thus only negative here constructs a false positive out of the turn to sound. This is not to say that the turn to sound, undertaken on a number of fronts, from critical interventions such as D. Morris's anthology Sound States to the archiving of sound recordings in tape recordings at many libraries and in MP3 files at Penn Sound, is suspicious. What I am saying is that the material substrate of language, as material or visual, becomes a ground for false positivity precisely through such second-order ideological positioning. As Carrie Nolan puts it in a letter set to appear in the next MLA newsletter, where Perloff's column first appeared, quote, the interest for future poetry criticism lies precisely in trying to understand the relation between the two, that is, between a history of displacement and the destabilizing energies of formal innovation. This was, in fact, the focus of our Diasporic Avant-Garde conference in 2004, which bridged the aesthetic cultural divide by presenting on the same stage formerly innovative poets, language school and post-language, with a range of global diasporic poetries, African-American, sub-Saharan African, Maghrebi, Francophone, Anglophone, Caribbean, and Hispanic New Yorican. The negativities explored in our conference thus included alterity and displacement, as well as the opacities of radical experiment and different languages. Nolan writes, quote, the most memorable moment of the conference may very well have been when the African-American performance poet Tracy Morris and the founding member of the experimental Poésie Sonore group, Bernard Heitzig, performed on the same stage. Morris's I'm Just a Little Girl recycles the syllables of the title over and over again, creating the sound effect of abject stuttering while at the same time lifting the phonic patterns into the register of music. Heitzig's Vaduz anaphorically presents the names of hundreds and hundreds of ethnic groups, starting with those closest, tout autour, to Vaduz, the capital of Liechtenstein, and gyrating outward towards ethnie, further and further away. Both poems utilize the repetition of phonemes, tout autour, tout autour, tout, 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 tout autour, or just a little girl, against the momentum of linearity and syntax, circular sound patterning creating a percussive accompaniment to a failed attempt to produce identity, an identity that nonetheless poses itself as such live and mic'd upon the stage. And I don't have Tracy's performance from that context, but I do have another. This is Tracy Morris and her piece Chain Gang.
That's the sound of the man working on a chain gang. Don't you know that's the sound of the man working on a chain gang? That's the sound of the man working on a chain gang. Don't you know that's the sound of the man working on a working it? That's the sound of the man working on a chain gang. Working at the working at the that's a sound working on the semantic sound of the man, sound of the man, sound of the man working on shit. Can't go, can't go, can't go. Same sound, same sound, same. Tick, 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 tick. Isn't that the egg room sitting on the egg? Oh, tick, 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 same sound, same man, same sound, same man, same sound, king. Isn't that egg room sitting on the egg?
The specter of Carrie Nolan being negative to Marjorie Perloff sets up a somewhat more loaded scenario as my second example, Bruce Andrews standing up to Bill O'Reilly, the O'Reilly factor, 2 November 2006. Granted, the comparison is itself a bit loaded, as the Andrews-O'Reilly debate centered not on Andrews's materially opaque, sonically dense, and culturally positioned language writing, but his teaching of the five biggest lies Bush told us about Iraq at Fordham University in the current political climate of academic cum red baiting being carried out by David Horowitz and his minions. Much as the allegedly disloyal text unmasked the phoniness of justificatory discourses for the war, negativity in the form of Andrews confronted false positivity in the form of O'Reilly. But there the comparison ends, in that it is precisely Andrews's being called up before the House Un-American Activities Committee's vestigial organ as Fox News talk show that conditions the kind of negativity he can bring to the dismantling of false positives. All O'Reilly really wanted from Andrews was a simple confirmation that he taught the book because he agrees with its content, that he promotes its views, i.e., that he is a communist. And this Andrews refused in a signal deployment of negativity to give him. So now we're going to access the Andrews, and we may have to wait through a 20-minute commercial here, unfortunately. It's the only way to get it. 20 seconds. 20 minutes. No, I mean negative, you know. Very. Yeah. Okay, yeah, click on to view your video. Yeah. It should be there. There it is. And high speed.
In a people-ready business.
That's, yeah, 11, 10 seconds left, yeah. Sound is coming. Okay.
Back in the book segment tonight, the factor outrage of the week. You may have heard the name Robert Scheer. He's a radical left-wing newspaper columnist who hates President Bush. Mr. Scheer was fired by the liberal Los Angeles Times last year, some say, because of his far, far left views. Now Mr. Scheer has co-authored a book called The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq. Well, the book is now required reading in a class at Fordham University called Analysis of International Politics. Does that sound fair and balanced? With us now, Professor Bruce Andrews, who teaches that class. I'm looking at your reading list here, in addition to the Scheer book. All of these books are pretty far left that you have on there, your reading curriculum. Would you not agree?
I would disagree.
Okay. Which book is fair and balanced or presents a pro-capitalist point of view?
A pro-capitalist point of view?
Yes. Well, so we live in a capitalist country. Which book on this reading list presents a pro-capitalist point of view?
The first half of this class is about how to explain individual countries' foreign policies. So it doesn't really even deal with the question of capitalism versus non-capitalist systems or pro-capitalist or not. So it's about It's about explanation, and it's about prescription. Things are going wrong, choices are made that people are unhappy with, and they're interested in a prescription.
Is there any reading list book in your class that is you could consider pro-American?
Pro-American?
Yeah. That means America's good.
This is not the focus of the class.
Okay. Obviously it isn't. Because you've got Scheer.
It's not a normative class. It's not about values.
Let me define it.
It's about understanding.
Yeah, understanding your point of view.
No, understanding why the government behaves the way that they do.
In your opinion. World ready or not, the manic logic of global capitalism describes modern capitalism as frightening, destabilizing, and running out of control. Scheer's book is a hate Bush diatribe. And you yourself, I think, are a far-left guy. Am I wrong in describing you that way?
That's not quite relevant to this issue.
Sure it is. You're the instructor of the class. Well, you shape the class.
What's the class about?
The class is about, seems to me, America's bad.
No. The class is about why do countries do what they do, and how do national leaders attempt to avoid having their behavior explained, and how they avoid
the five biggest lies Bush told us about Iraq. Come on.
Fabulous item pedagogically in getting students to understand the strategies that governments use to slip out from under a prescription.
I wouldn't mind that. If I were in your class, I wouldn't mind reading that book, but I'd like to read another book that balances it out.
This book is an analysis of government strategy.
By a Bush hater.
No, but the point is you're presented with the strategy, you're presented with the rhetoric, you can see what it's designed to do. What it's designed to do is to either provide some justificatory discourse around the policy to increase support.
But it's all one way. You're feeding these kids, 35 undergrads, and you had to do a grad. I don't care about the grad class as much. They ought to be done. You're feeding these guys a one-world view, and, you know, it's not right. You ought to have
one world? You mean Wendell Willkie?
No, the one world is capitalism's bad, Bush is a liar, America's bad, Scheer is no credibility.
That's not the point of the class.
Scheer doesn't have any credibility. Why would you use a book, if you're an academic, and you have been for 31 years, why would you use a book by a guy who was fired by the LA Times for being irresponsible in his opinions? Why would you use a book like that?
Because I'm not using it as an embodiment of his opinions.
It's required reading.
No, but what is it designed to do in the classroom, which you don't have any sense of? It's not designed to convince people of a different opinion they might have about the war in Iraq.
Your opinion and Scheer's opinion are the same.
It's designed to help them think it through.
Your opinion and Scheer's opinion are the same.
What is Scheer's opinion about why the United States is in Iraq?
All right. Here's what one of your former students said, a guy named Bruce Andrews.
That's
the professor,
me. Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
I'm writing in to complain about my own class.
You should. A former student said, the professor made everyone raise their hand if they had a family member who worked in the CIA. He believed the U.S. government assassinated JFK in order to open up Cuba to capitalist exploitation. That's what the professor...
Well, that's not... I teach another class.
Is that true?
I teach another class on the Kennedy assassination.
And you believe the CIA, the government ordered Kennedy's assassination?
No, I don't. All right. But I also don't believe Lee Harvey Oswald did.
All right.
So it's more complicated. It's more complicated.
It is, and I'm not in your class.
And context is crucial.
Put one book on here that isn't an anti-American book, and I wouldn't have any problem with it. But we appreciate you being a stand-up guy.
Well,
next, we'll wrap things up. The most ridiculous item.
Yay, Bruce!
Yeah. Good job. Good job, Bruce. And in my transcription at the end, I say Andrews blushes. You know, that little compliment there. Andrews is limited rhetorically by the history of such encounters, in the kind of negativity he can deploy, and he is being quite careful. He does not pursue the book's stated agenda to unmask lies or dismantle ideology, but couches his motivations in pedagogical terms. The book is fabulous to teach because it encourages analysis. He does not respond to direct red baiting. You yourself are a far left guy, by either affirming or denying it. Rather, he tactically claims that's not relevant, neither affirming nor denying. He does not finally respond to O'Reilly's overall agenda that the teaching of a left text demands a balanced text that defends capitalism and the American way of life. Rather, the academy is a professional, legitimate, autonomous arena of critical thinking, period. Andrews's humanism surfaces here. What he does do is to unmask O'Reilly's assumptions is to use the tactic of the returned question. a pro-capitalist point of view, pro-American? What's the class about? One world? You mean like Wendell Willkie? What's it designed to do in the classroom? What is Scheer's opinion about why the United States is in Iraq? And the twice repeated refrain, do you know? Andrews' answers reflect a long tradition of dialectic, but they cannot engage the political content of O'Reilly's bait, Scheer's un-Americanism, and the degree to which Andrews may agree with it. He cannot match negative with negative, say, I dispute your right to say that, or aggressively characterize O'Reilly's perspective. Although I have heard criticisms that Andrews' deflecting of O'Reilly's provocations risked being unreadable to a majority of viewers, I think that Andrews is actually saying something in his refusal to answer questions directly. First, of course, he is standing up to O'Reilly and thus encouraging through identification that others do the same in similar circumstances. The rhetoric of red or liberal baiting will thus have less effect in the long run. But he is doing something more than that. As with Slavoj Žižek's example of the hole torn in the Romanian flag on the cover of Tarrying with the Negative, Andrews works through a logic of ideological subtraction. He is carving out a hole in right ideology to show its incoherence, not by a point-by-point disagreement with O'Reilly's 2 plus 2 equals 5 logic, but by questioning the coherence of the discourse itself in larger form. His affect itself on the screen, informally dressed, as Ron Silliman described it, also works toward this reversal. If Andrews turned out to be, in O'Reilly's grudging praise, a stand-up guy, it was not by standing up, but sitting down, not getting excited, not overreaching. Although he does talk over him, which is a nice move. The negative moment here points both to the confinement of the positive discourse and an effective strategy for beginning to dismantle it by not giving in to its assumptions. That, and a bit more airtime, and we may have a hope of turning back the Horowitzes. Andrews' negative intervention into public discourse and ideological positivity is not merely influenced by his poetry, which was entirely too complicated to deal with on the segment. It is an extension of his poetics. It projects a negative logic embedded in its construction through modes of radical questioning or dialectic that initially structured it, as in the detotalizing and perverse questioning of one of Andrews's early essays in poetics. And I'll read this one. It's from the essay on John Wiener's. But what I remarked about this, even wrote about it in Total Syntax, was the use of the question as a kind of creating a space for a negative poetics. So does one ever develop a thought? How has density proven? Can someone simply decorate the gaps and lacks? By what manner, in manners, in a manner of speaking, is decorum the sensible adjunct we want to a sumptuous surveillance? Confusion, decor, meaning, memory, body, space, self, rhetoric, reality? Okay, that's the rhetoric, let's say, of an early critical essay of Andrews. The anti-discursive use of the return question can be compared to Andrews' own construction of false positivity in the language text, I don't have any papers, so shut up. And here I'll play a little section from the last part. This would be Shut Up 100. Yeah? You see that? There would be Andrew's index and then Andrew's Shut Up 100. You can play the index, it doesn't matter, but Shut Up 100 is better. It's on the desktop if it's not. I want his voice because actually both Andrews and Morris were in this experiment at Diasporic Avant-Garde.
The last piece is called You Made This World, We Didn't.
There we go. So imagine him speaking this to
you
O'Reilly.
You Made This World,
the last
we
piece
didn't.
Is called You Made This
Spirit
World,
of Rectum,
didn't.
Praise for Absolution. Candy in your
you
rice.
Made this world.
Big black snowman is the best.
Spirit of
capsized evening for absolution.
Candy in your rice.
By comparison. Big black snowman is the best. Capsized even profound poodle consorts by comparison. Price plunge fused with light, conical instead of ideas. No gods, no bosses. Phony emotions materialize on drapery aura. Flurries of cream arrows,
Doppler on eggshell gilded optometrist. It noticed things. Corruptly in the crosshairs want to institutionalize their pertinent strut. Suck it, more like it. It will have been more sooner than you would not have thought. Character, action, music, diction, thought, spectacle. Easy to attach the tubing when plutocrats were bold. Designer jeans, you go into your damaged clam act. Computerized...
That's fine. Okay, that's fine. So that this work, as you know, goes on, and as anyone who's familiar with it knows, it's very negative. But what I'm pointing to is its location not as simply a textual effect or a sonic effect, but as public discourse. And I think Andrews was always writing in public, and he always wanted to return his work to the public, and O'Reilly actually gave him the chance to do so. The obdurate language of the poetry, of Andrews' poetry, has its origins as counter-discourse in the mode of questioning of the poetics, and both anticipate Andrews' response to O'Reilly as decapitationist of the mass media. That's from another section. The subtractive logic of, quote, there's no place for what we do, let's die, sets up both material language as aesthetic practice and Andrews' political intervention in the politics of red-baiting, from HUAC to the New Right. He cannot avow, but he can remain negative and unassimilable. Compare this to Allen Ginsberg's tactics in the 1950s to an equally vicious political climate after the McCarthy Inquisition, to are you now or ever have you been a communist, and by extension, Jew and queer. Ginsberg responded that he is all three at once. America, I'm putting my queer shoulder to the wheel. The transformative hybrid identity Ginsberg formed and enacted in the 60s, quote, a symptom of anxieties, inequities, or cultural displacements of one sort or another, if there ever was one, is impossible for us now. This is a moment of cultural logic, with O'Reilly staging the scene of instruction that is ideology. Andrews' response, as poet and political theorist, can only be a subtractive one. It is this subtractive technique I want to chart in the vicissitudes of the aesthetic in order to recover its cultural logic. I, too, have been confronted by a loyalty oath. It was for my first real job in the summer before my freshman year on a University of California contract to a hospital in Oakland. A few weeks earlier that summer, I had a brief stint as a warehouse worker in Emeryville for a company that happened to shelter a number of anxious, displaced leftists ousted from unions by McCarthy, fleeing the Hungarian Revolution, on the run from Yugoslavia. Quote, will you defend the Constitution of the State of California against all enemies, foreign or domestic? I had no choice but to affirm. I ought to have confessed my negativity on the spot. It would take me years to express it in either aesthetic or political ways. But the negativity I'm focusing on here is not a personal matter. Rather, it concerns how the strategies of radical poetics are informed by the tactics of public discourse, and whether a comparable standard of public discourse can, in turn, be brought to questions of poetics. Next section is music. There is no one-size-fits-all negativity, nor should there be. Two forms of negativity combine in the above examples: aesthetic techniques of subtraction, originating with the dialectical stance of perverse questioning and leading to horizons of the material text and the refusal of closure, and cultural logics of opposition and scapegoating as red-baiting. I want to follow the aesthetics of negativity, and particularly in techniques of subtraction and refusal of closure that lead beyond composition to the materiality of sound in post-war and recent avant-gardes. My first example is John Cage's 1974 masterpiece of chance composition, Étude Australe, a piece I listened to endlessly alongside radical improvisers like Anthony Braxton and Cecil Taylor in the period represented in the grand piano. A work of great compositional complexity that progresses from an austere minimalism of discrete notes and chords separated by live pauses to complex chord clusters that succeed on one another. It is structured by negative means through the use of chance procedures. Why don't we play a couple of those examples? Thank you. another one. Third one. As Cage said, in my music, there is no system of relations any more than there is of tonality. So negative definition. One finds all chords. There are chords that are completely classical, major or minor, but these are completely unexpected and unforeseeable. When they happen, they have extraordinary freshness, as if one heard them for the first time. This refusal of system, either tonal, atonal, or compositional, is still accomplished by systematic means. When Cage applied transparent paper over a star map of the southern hemisphere and interpreted the distance and magnitude of individual stars as single notes and chord clusters using a system derived from the I Ching. As the work progresses, the occurrence of 2 to 5 note chords increases in frequency and density. There are precise rules for string openings and dampings, and playing the chords given by the allegorical method. The piece is also open to the performer's interpretation, as neither tempo nor dynamics are specified. Only the proportional distance between clusters is annotated. The two major recordings of the piece, Greta Sultans, for whom the piece was written, for her impressive ability to realize complex chords, and Stefan Schleiermacher's, who attends more to resonances than to technical difficulty, thus differ in length from 170 minutes to 204 minutes. While the piece itself is indeed built up through a compositional method, it produces an experience for the listener in which piano music is reduced to minimal elements and built up to complex relationships in a temporal continuum that is not structured through repeating increments of time. Rather, the time of physics, astronomical time, is mapped through the use of the I Ching onto the physiological time of the listener. A second order of negativity thus occurs at the conceptual level, as the compositional system used in the composition renders phenomena, stars, sounds, as knowable only in the second order interpretation of chance procedures, the distance and magnitude of the stars as the inaccessible substrate of noumena provides a pure negativity that foregrounds the gap between them and their interpretation as temporalized sounds. For Adorno, this gap is precisely the locus of aesthetic negativity. It is the way the unexpected events of complex strategies can make strange categories for understanding experience. Cage sees his strategies, in turn, as a politics of imminent critique, as a challenge to conventional understanding. Quote, I had begun to take an interest in the writing of difficult music, namely etudes, because of the world system, which to many of us seemed hopeless. I thought if there was a musician who gave the public an example, if he did the impossible, that he would induce somebody who had been impressed by this performance to change the world, a change he will produce through strictly compositional means. My second example of negative techniques in music is from the contemporary noise band Wolf Eyes, which I first heard at the 2002 Detroit Electronic Music Festival. In the constructivist moment, I compared Detroit techno to El Lissitzky's proposal for a realization of, quote, the electromechanical show Victory Over the Sun in the Soviet 1920s. This is a description of that show. Quote, At the flick of the switch, the sound system is turned on, and the whole place may suddenly reverberate with the din of a railroad station, or the roar of Niagara Falls, or the pounding of a steel rolling mill, as an early instance of industrial aesthetics, or noise bands. Wolfeyes Set at the DEMF was an even better example of this than techno, an over-the-top, high-volume buildup of electronic and percussive sound played as one long blast with no discernible progression in an underground cement-walled space where sound ricocheted from all sides, nearing the point of injury for those without earplugs. Wolfeyes Aesthetics of Interruption represents a genre that has been under development in Detroit and elsewhere since at least the 1990s. One could find it locally at venues like the Gold Dollar, a former stripper transvestite bar that was its premier venue. The following video gives an idea of the affect generated in Wolfeyes' performances. We'll go to the movie for about 30 seconds. I saw, actually. Wolfeyes' interventions take place at a crossroads where three roads meet. Post-punk rock guitar, pushing aggressive strumming and feedback to a point of overload. Industrial synthesizer effects and homemade instrument effects, both art-oriented and commercial, that use unpleasurable effects of technological overload as objects of aesthetic reflection. And vocal cues from other genres, particularly horror films. Each of these aesthetics, while based in a sonic materiality that generates bodily responses through high volumes of distorted voices, machine-generated noise, instrumental feedback, and rhythmic pounding, invokes a different cultural register. Wolfeyes is working out a space of negativity not reducible to mere frontal assault, although I hardly expect you to believe me from that clip. Rather, the embodied affects produced by the music lead to a space of reflective listening that, according to audience members I've spoken with, can be personally redemptive, a kind of deep joy in a space in which the negativity of sonic overload cancels everything else out. Wolfeyes thus exists in a contradictory tension between the obvious performative negativity of loud and unpleasant sounds and an evacuated space that reflects on the microscopic changes in the sonic density and temporality of the music. Their music performs a kind of emptying out as much as an inescapable wall of sound that is irreducibly present. And now let's listen to the driller. This is a bit of a long human cut. Like Anthony Braxton and working with Carla Harriman, they also obviously have a very large subcultural reception. The music is positioned culturally in terms of a specific politics. It locates where, in that reception, it locates where a kind of romantic anti-capitalism can be found. In the words of a web fanzine, this is, quote, "Fuck, man. Cite all the top-shelf noise and power electronic bands until you're blue in the face. White House, New Blockaders, Nurse with Wound, whatever, but none possess the internal being of Wolf Eyes. The former were performance artists flirting with the dire circumstances of the human condition in the abstract, but Wolf Eyes just fucking are the dire circumstances of the modern human condition. Ever watch a movie about the future and the future is so oppressively grim, violent, foreign, and insipid that even a romance with nihilism seems way too quaint and inappropriate of a response? And then you realize we live in drastic fucking times and Wolf Eyes is drastic fucking music." On the one hand, this rhetoric recalls Paul Mann's account in Massocriticism, his collection of essays skeptical of critical negativity, of what he terms stupid avant-gardes. Surfers, skateboarders, glueheads, or Marilyn Manson groupies, so immersed in genres of popular culture that their negativity is simply a lived condition without any possibility of critical distance outside it. For Wolf Eyes fans, however, it is their inner being rather than conformity to a particular genre's norms that is the point. Genres, seen as canceling out anything that might be felt as erratic through the sheer physicality of a wall of sound, open to a space of pure reflection on these drastic fucking times we live in. Cage, it may be recalled, when asked how to respond to very loud music, advocated standing directly in front of the speakers to the point that one's ears hurt, a necessary experience. For Wolf Eyes, as for Cage, sonic irreducibility is not only an aesthetic imperative, but is motivated as a cultural critique, with Cage constructing a genre, and Wolf Eyes exploring the space between genres, and actually micro-niching a genre out of that exploration of differences between genres. So it's a niched genre. There's no one-size-fits-all negativity applying to both. Merely aesthetic negativity, while fitting for Cage, fails in the case of Wolf Eyes. Further, there is no single oppositional moment in Wolf Eyes' cultural politics, but a necessary pluralism, a post-avant practice that makes Cage's strategies look just a bit normative. Okay, so third section is art, so we can click on now the PowerPoint to art. Art. I'm arguing for a heterogeneity of aesthetic effects, including those of the negative, as criticizing the positivity of genres or as situated in the space between them. For Adorno, negativity keeps aesthetic experience open, so it can never be subordinate to concepts, and thus conveys the force of a detotalizing critique. But Adorno's negativity cannot account for genre itself. It must assume it as the ground for the proper role negativity will play within and as the aesthetic. This explains why Adorno was so bollocksed when it came to jazz. Though obviously it was music, it was beyond the boundary of what counted as the proper genre for Adorno. It also accounts for why Adorno was so embarrassed when the detotalizing critique he had so carefully constructed was returned to him in a form he could not have envisioned in the culture of the 60s, the moment that breasts were laid bare. The, quote, Mandarin modernism that has since been tagged to his project has had the unfortunate effect of misreading aesthetic theory as just another species of formalism, which everyone agrees is suspect, while not understanding the greater force of his critical use of the aesthetic as negative. The aesthetic always reintroduces its own form of positivity. This is the risk of the false positive I have described with the turn to sound. And so, the aesthetic does not always have the best account of what the positive really is. Between aesthetic intervention and the possibility of culture it wishes to criticize lies the vexed question of genre, the type of positivity in its adherence to conventional or stylistic norms, no matter how recently constructed, that is constructed by the work of art itself or by the species of art itself, the kind of art it is. Otherwise put, there is no pure negativity that stems directly from the isolated work. It is always mediated by genre, which may have its own investments in affirmative culture, as we know from the example of rock and roll, our version of Adorno's trouble with jazz. My concluding pair of examples are taken from the context of the current visual arts in Germany. Two exhibitions I saw over last year that reflect the high level of awareness of the stakes of negativity in aesthetic and cultural terms in the post-1989 context. The first was a career retrospective of conceptual photographers Berndt and Hilla Becker, seen at the Hamburger Bahnhof in Berlin in fall 2005. The Beckers are well known for their genre-defining black and white images of industrial buildings and landscapes, water towers, mine heads, blast furnaces, brick kilns, and sites of industrial production, either singly or grouped together in series. The overall effect of serial production is to de-objectify the individual images and to place them in the larger context of the kind of images they are. So the Beckers will present 25 photographs of mine heads in western Pennsylvania on one wall and 25 photographs of similar but not identical mine heads in Belgium or the Ruhr on the other. The similarities and differences of the individuals in each set add up to the construction of a type, one that departs from mere functionality of utilitarian objects and approaches through their discursive formation as a type, a conceptual order that is anything but representational. The Beckers have located in the dialectic of like and unlike that founds the genealogy of industrial objects a relation of object to concept. This is a mine head, that is a blast furnace, that exploits local differences as it foregrounds general similarities. The aesthetic is thus a form of discourse that orders objects as like and unlike, in so doing employing the negativity between them. But the positivity that results, an aesthetic one, and based in the very direct recognition one experiences of something else not subordinated to representation, is set in direct opposition to their material existence or social function. By rigorously framing the objects each in a similar way, selecting distances and perspectives that treat each object as a similar kind of thing, by photographing only on cloudy days to minimize shadows, and above all to exclude any presence of living human beings, unless very small, the Beckers create a conceptual effect that depends on a formalism of shot selection and grouping. This is a negative strategy, to begin with isolating the object out of its cultural context, that of, say, larger patterns of deindustrialization that end with the postmodern, and followed by reframing the object in a new and highly constructed series. Construction is thus transposed from the material history of industrial capitalism, mediated by the loss of culture, as it accedes to the postmodern order, and represented as an object of reflection. This reflection, as a rigorous play of the negative, is a highly pleasurable one, in that the loss of object status of the industrial conveys an undercurrent of ludic effects or desires that predict, in the construction of even larger series, the promise of a new social order. If the aesthetic thus can, by manipulation of the relation of object to concept, become the founding moment for a renovated cultural politics, the status of its genres is confirmed. The Beckers, more than anything else, practice photography in and as a cultural strategy that renders the world more than legible, open to new interpretations in its reframing, identifying the negative work of Ostrinieni with both specific techniques and totality. So all that work of seriality basically comes back and creates a new object, and that object is the object of conceptual photography. And in the exhibition, there were room after room of these images, so that it was an effective overload of these serial forms that was really working. Okay, next. My contrasting example is the Leipzig painter Neo Rauch, who rigorously avoids and even undermines all such discourses of totalization in his use of dissonant motifs. The Beckers are informed, first of all, by questions of conceptual art and its parallel history to moments of social transformation. As the 1998 exhibition Global Conceptualism showed, there was a close relation between conceptual art and oppositional politics in the 1960s. The Beckers explore the fault lines between concept and material history of 19th century industrialization and its ironic teleology in German post-war consumer society. It is as if the economic base, in Marx's terms, had become commoditized as superstructure. Rauch, originating in the deformed worker state of the GDR, East Germany, sees reification and the relationship between base and superstructure as partial and contingent, to be placed alongside other narrative and iconographic elements. The Becker's totality is all objects of production placed in exchange as luxury goods, while for Becker, the fallen forms of state bureaucracy, survivals of the NS period or German Romanticism, and the market economy are all equally present as a surreal mix of dominant, residual, and emergent cultures, where one cannot really tell which is which. Where the Becker's use of frame and series aligns the cut of aesthetic negativity precisely with rational subordination, Rauch refuses, above all, any final form of rationalization, or icon, or narrative, for that matter. Where the Beckers can be seen as offering a conceptual calculus of the totalized world, Rauch constructs and dismantles social allegories that cannot be totalized or interpreted within a stable framework. Rather, the objects, actions, frames, atmospheres, tableau, signage, personification, architectures, and landscapes Rauch mixes are all incomplete, and none provides a basis for interpreting the other. At the same time, the figures in Rauch's tableau are all doing something. One cannot tell precisely to what end or at what scale, however. His work is not a social surrealism, which it's been called actually by New York critics, though many of the scenarios resulting from Rauch's investigation in incomplete social logics could be called dreams, but a presentation of contradictory moments of social being that do not resolve. The aesthetic begins with the pleasure and strangeness one feels in Rauch's non-narrative effects, identified with formal incompletion in his account of cultural logics, while the Becker's aesthetic occurs in the gap between concept and material. The negativity that results founds a genre of conceptual photography for the Beckers, but Rauch's negativity occurs in the incomplete subordination of cultural elements by genre. And there's plenty of genre painting, I mean, quite literally, in these works. What I see in Neo Rauch is a space open for reflection on incomplete cultural logics in the terms of their manifest displacement. While the Beckers depict construction literally, what I see in Neo Rauch is a space open for reflection on incomplete cultural logics in the terms of their manifest displacement and their latent capacity for realization. While the Beckers depict construction literally, Rauch is the real constructivist. And interesting to meditate on. Well, maybe go back to that one. It's okay. Meditate on that. We can leave that one up, actually, just as a place to hang. So I'm going to end with two things, a little coda and the definition of negativity in Chapter 6, which Aaron had sent around as part of the publicity. So what is negativity? It's what you came here to find out, right? Negativity, no. Not this. Not this, Ron. Negativity has more than the single attribute of the logical operation of negation performed by the particle not. Rather, its meaning will be specified by its construction or positioning within philosophical, psychological, or cultural systems of which it is a constitutive part. Within such larger systems, we may speak of negativity as the inaccessible substrate of nature that cannot be known directly, a posited abstraction that, I wonder if I've covered all of these examples. We'll see if I have. I certainly did the first one. Negativity is the inaccessible substrate of nature that cannot be known directly, a posited abstraction that co-determines the form of the concept in its positive content, a desire that cannot be integrated into positive forms of representation, the temporal and spatial limits of the disclosure of being, a moment of excess or non-integration fundamental to the establishment of any set of identities, the construction of a limit of participation in a culture beyond which a given activity no longer is admissible, the political rupture of revolutionary politics, and a form of behavior or acting out that is unacceptable. More concretely put, negativity is common to a range of concepts that includes non-identity, antagonism, nihilism, revolt, defamiliarization, rupture, opposition, dissociation, conflict, delusion, void, emptiness. Negativity, as it occurs in the field, so to speak, with the radical forms of the avant-garde, partakes of any or all of these modes, even as its final horizon, a denial of positivity, locates each instance as a potential form of critique. Negativity is in the air. It has surged in the polls. The first progressive moment of negativity in memory. Even impeachment is a possibility. I look forward to immediate change, a relief from the eternalization and reproduction of bad cultural logics of subordination and a renewed sense of aesthetic agency. What this will mean in practice, I hope, will be a turn from static devices of aesthetic construction where the work is a placeholder for possibilities that cannot be realized or even imagined towards projects in the Sartrean sense that activate the values of cultural reflection, knowledge, and agency. There can be no one-size-fits-all negativity. Let us undermine false positivity on multiple fronts. Okay, our presentation. So, I don't really want to hear from any of you. I'd like to hear from you. And, you know, I was going to ask, Ron and Bob, can I just get the room before I get you guys, okay? Because we go so far back, it could be confusing for other people. But if you want to lead the way, Ron, you go right ahead.
I have a question.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, you know, before Ron goes.
I had trouble following this, by the way. You read
The plot? Well, I guess there would be a couple of scenes of that, and so one scene would be, like the Kantian sublime, where you're looking at something that exceeds you, and it exceeds the limit of your capacity for understanding, and so the degree to which something is unthinkable, you know, then has a negative moment, right? There's, you know, you cannot comprehend, you cannot subordinate it to a concept, so that would be one. You know, one sort of internalized subjective way of thinking about that which is negative. It's something that exceeds your capacity to cognize or to represent. Let's say that then moves into modes of representation. You want to represent something having to do with that experience. And then you have I can't really tell you how big the Grand Canyon is, right? So you have these negative ways of pointing toward the failure of representation in relationship to that which exceeds your understanding of it. That would be one account. Let's say there's another account which has something to do with cultural logics, that which is not assimilable or understandable by a group of people. Let's say there's a kind of community that accepts certain kinds of aesthetic experience as aesthetic. The notion that cultural logic is based in a relationship to the object, the work of art, and it's you know, and its ability to be expressed or discussed conflicts with works that cannot be interpreted by that community, right? So there'd be a communal notion or a cultural notion of that which is inadmissible. So would all cultures necessarily have the same standard for what counts as negative? No, they wouldn't, because they would be different cultures, right? Certain cultures tolerate, there's an affirmative culture of noise bans, right? And then there's also a culture that sees noise bans as negative objects. So one of the things that's going on then in the politics of, you know, of the negative is working with the conditions of interpretation of that negative act. And so there isn't a final horizon of simply a negative that remains so, you know, for all time, at least within aesthetic practice, I would claim. That would be an example. So I think that there are rigorous ways of talking about what counts as the negative, but there are a number of them, right? What's the use?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's say one use is you go down the road and you produce art that is in opposition to the dominant culture. And you basically, you know, think, you know, in complex ways that, you know, this work is going to have some negative effect. And then let's say it becomes a moment of social reproduction. It turns back into a logic by which the culture reproduces itself, becomes affirmative culture. It seems to me that this is an absolutely ubiquitous concern in the arts, it seems to me, for any artist. And it seems to me that being able to think through the formal construction of the negative work and the logic that it's being inserted into gives you a way of thinking through questions such as, is the turn to sound affirmative? Is it, you know, is it a false positivity? Is it simply materializing the works of the avant-garde that had radical cultural intentions, like Tracy Morris's, into an MP3 that can be traded and downloaded as an object, just like we can exchange any other, we could say Albert Eiler, we could say any other, Wolf Eyes, basically, we could buy it online. And so as a material object or as a commodity, then maybe it loses its oppositional force. And so thinking through the question of whether the avant-garde or any other form of agency maintains its force strikes me as the site for wanting to think through precisely what kind of negativity is implied. So with Bruce, you know, we looked at the two forms of negativity in his presentation. One was inspired by the aesthetic. It's his method of negative questioning. And the second was really just to stand up to O'Reilly, right, as a form of, like, not being red-baited. I will not be red-baited, right, or I will not be academic baited in his case. And I think what's interesting there is the ways, you know, the play of the negative, of the different sources of his oppositional strategy and the way he negotiated that. He drew from his art practice, right, but he also drew from the long history of HUAC hearings and his political knowledge of those things. So we've got two scales there to work with. So this is why I think thinking the negative is important. It just doesn't get you the same answer every time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what I'm trying to do is move from a single form of negativity that's associated with the historical avant-garde, right? And the problem with that is it gets sublated, it gets taken to the next level, it gets institutionalized, it loses its force, the avant-garde basically is trivial. And plenty of people think this, right? They think, the avant-garde was a historical development, and there is really no such thing as avant-garde agency anymore, okay? And so each of the pairs that I presented, there was one example where there's a kind of thesis, antithesis, synthesis kind of logic, right? A fairly simple, straightforward, negativity that was being debated. And what I was looking for is places where multiple logics are being negotiated. These could be different, you know, the ways different genres could be looked at, the ways that different registers of social representation in Neo-Rauch, right, are being organized. And so my interest in the negative isn't compositional, right? It's a cultural logic, but it's one that's plural, that, you know, that works between numbers of competing claims that it, you know, that might address. And I think, you know, in Andrews, he did that successfully. He actually played one negativity off against the other. And that gets us out of, he found something in the cultural logic that he could handle or comprehend through his stance of kind of resistant materiality or backing off questioning, the kind of thing that he does in his work. So that's really great because he didn't get baited, you know. And so O'Reilly wanted to, you know, position him and wipe him out. And he actually inserted himself into the cultural logic of the scene. And I think by defining it, at least to us, you know, I think maybe to the majority of viewers, this is a very strange segment. But I think you know, we can see the moves. And I think he just got in to the structure there. And that isn't a single moment of rejection, in a way. And so that's kind of one of the things I'm playing with, right? So you say the limits. I think I'm looking for a pluralizing of the negative and a way in which it's not simply a compositional pluralism, but it's a cultural pluralism that does involve aesthetic negativity, the structuring of the work, but shows how the structuring of the work actually plays in to logics of culture, which can't be seen as identical to the work of art. Yeah.
You mentioned Nietzsche at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that as you were talking.
Right.
I was wondering if you could sort of flesh out the connections between Nietzsche's, I guess, flesh out Nietzsche's negativity to begin with and sort of maybe connect his techniques of negativity to those that you're looking at in these artists and musicians.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to do a very careful job of going through the essay because obviously it's there to match up. There are a couple things. One is the, you know, the use of the aesthetic as depositivizing, right? And so the positivity that he's concerned with is 19th century historicism and the account of science that goes along with that historicism. The aesthetic moment is a moment of radical forgetting and of giving up on the teleological constructions that, you know, account for that positivity. And that's the first thing. And then he sets up, as you know, a series of kinds of historicism, first being monumental, and in a way, monumental historicism might be that of political opposition, a grand narrative of political opposition, as in HUAC and red baiting. So Nietzsche's monumental historicity then does seem to, you know, move in the direction of the dialectic of power and domination, let's say in state politics. Okay, the second kind of negativity that Nietzsche is not, it thinks is limited, is that of radical particularity. And the example there is collecting. So as bad as a monumental historian could be, then a collector is as bad as that. And this is just the fetishizing of the objects of history, and it would be 19th century philology or museum collecting or whatever. In our period, I think the aesthetics of radical particularity would be forms of composition that radically particularize. And there is a whole... there's a whole aesthetic practice around that. The New Sentence is a good example of an aesthetic of radical particularity. And then the third kind of historicity that he's interested in is critical, right? And that's obviously reflective, and it doesn't engage either of the two forms of narrative or material historicism that he's been attacking. So what I would say there is that this critical historicity aligns really well with what I'm looking for here. It's something that's imminent within the negotiations that one undertakes as historical and as aesthetic. So I think that's as far as I can go right now, but, you know.
And I was also thinking as you were saying that one of the rhetorical techniques he uses all the time is comedy, various forms of punning or sort of the deconstruction of the formal language of scholarship.
Right. Yeah.
Humbleness, you know, kill the spirit of gravity. And then this comic voice, this use of the rhetoric of the scholars, of the philosophers, of the historians, of the philologists, and then undermining it with puns and with irony, and this kind of parodic voice that runs through all of his work and gets stronger and stronger as you move toward the end. I think that's, to me, that's part of what he's doing with his negativity, that it's undermine history with these, you know, 1,000 voices of laughter, that polyphonic laughter.
Yeah, and I wonder then, you know, in these examples, who the comedians are, you know, and it would be interesting to try to talk about that. I mean, is this comic in a certain way, you know, hysterically funny in some sense? But for me, the Beckers are hysterically funny as well, you know. I mean, you know, the water towers are outrageously funny. And, you know, but that's, you know, and I think what that has to do with really is the dematerialization or the unlinking of the image from reference. And once it's unlinked, it opens up to, you know, all kinds of ludic elements, right?
That's, you know, this whole concept of the Dionysian,
yeah,
underlying,
yeah,
all of that.
Yeah, yeah, right. So these mine heads are incredibly, you know, like they're passional objects, you know. I mean, they're not just industrial, you know, they're not material, facts of material production, they're passional, you know, and I think that would be the Dionysian underpinnings of, you know, what do you think a mine head really is about, you know. It's, yeah, it's passion, you know, and but it's funny that it looks like a mine head. Trying to find the joke, you know, but no, I mean, your point is completely well taken, and it's, but I think also for the aesthetic, with Nietzsche, it's the radical forgetting that is really the determinant of that experience which we call aesthetic. You know, that you in order to have a work, you have to forget, you know. And all of the artists that I presented do that. You know, they have that at the beginning. You know, in order to be in the art, you have to forget. So, Ron.
Yeah, this is wonderful. In a terrible sort of way.
Yeah.
One of the reasons O'Reilly, I think, picks Bruce in for this particular move and assault is the Robert Scheer book.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Scheer, you mentioned Horowitz,
mm-hmm.
David Horowitz, and Scheer and Horowitz have a particular history that's almost as long as ours, in that they co-authored a best-selling book in the 1960s for which Snyder took credit, called Soul on Ice.
yeah,
and,
can see where that's going.
Yes, and they went, you know, gave the credit to Aldrich Cleaver,
right.
For whom it was like an as told to,
yeah,
kind of situation before he became a Republican. What was he? Sort of a gypsy garbage collector.
He was a preacher.
Slash,
yeah, right.
Codpiece.
Yeah, right.
Codpiece entrepreneur.
Right.
Yeah.
Which was a very peculiar move that would be interesting to look at as like a social history. And one of the things that the whole thing you were talking about that struck me as being both interesting, tantalizing, and frustrating at the same time was the way that social history sort of attaches to everything. You were talking about niche genres at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about, well, why is it, what is it about a niche genre that makes it that phenomenon? Why is there not simply a spectrum of genre possibilities in
mm-hmm.
any given medium?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's the social that specifically mm-hmm. comes and causes everything to slot around
mm-hmm.
something we call it the novel,
mm-hmm.
and then there are these other things that are sort of like,
mm-hmm.
maybe not quite the novel,
right.
that end up in those kinds of niches. And the noise music, I mean, you know, that can be described in so many ways by reference to other kinds of art forms. Yanis Xenakis,
mm-hmm. oh, yeah.
the sonic youth by way of Pere Ubu or
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting to see, because what cancels out that edging moment that institutionalizes all avant-garde, including skateboarders and I suspect eventually noise music,
mm-hmm.
Is the way in which people adjust to it and learn to talk about it. And they learn how to frame it, and it gets framed itself. And, you know, at some point that always happens. You know, if they're already performing with
mm-hmm.
Carla Harriman and Anthony Braxton,
mm-hmm.
they have already been defined not as graffiti, you know, but as graffiti gone into the galleries
mm-hmm.
in that same way.
Mm-hmm. And that's you know, that's the old danger of the avant-garde. I mean, that's the Berger argument of the institutionalization of the avant-garde. And if you keep falling into that pattern, you know, then you overlook a lot of things. You overlook specific histories of developing particular cultural strategies. For instance, so let's say Wolfeyes came out of both an aesthetic series and a social series, and they made something out of it. And let's say they're on tour with Sonic Youth, which they have been, so they're, they're niching their way up into, into commodity status. I mean, I think the argument you want to avoid is the one that simply identifies, the sublation of negativity with the market, because there are multiple logics at work, one of which could simply be the packaging of wolf eyes and mainstreaming the product. But there's still relationships that are determined by the work itself, right, that one attends to. So I would say recent Bob Dylan, as heavily marketed as it was, approaches Neo-Rauch at times in its negotiation of the negative as an imminent structure. And I think that is hearable, and it is heard through all of the slickness of the mixing board and all of the terrific musicianship that's on there. You know, there's still places where there's a kind of very active, unlinking of false positivity. And that's precisely the point. Where is the work actually operating in that sense? Where is it attacking that, illicit thing called a false consensus? Right? When O'Reilly comes in with a set of gobbledygook notions that he thinks are founded in a right-wing consensus, and Andrews, simply by answering him in certain ways, shows how illogical they are, how incoherent they are, then I think Andrews has done his work, right? And so it was on TV, so what, right? That's my answer to the whole question of the media or the mediatization of agency. I don't think that can be the only problem or the only criterion, let's say, for measuring the force of an oppositional aesthetic. Yeah.
I don't mean that somebody else saw.
There's in the back.
Yeah, I think graffiti is a really interesting example because it resists appropriation in a very specific way. Autographing in a specific aesthetic walls of an art gallery is one thing, right? But that would never be autographing the world at large illegally. So something illegal, any kind of illegal art form, resists appropriation. Mm-hmm. So, you can have an aesthetic, like there's this video game where people steal cars and deal drugs and all of that kind of thing. But if you have an art form that's actually something that you can get jailed for, then it seems like it resists in a very different way being appropriated, becoming high art, that kind of thing.
And I don't think the issue really is that it's strictly the illegal status that makes it interesting. It's, this concept of cultural work. What cultural work is graffiti doing? When I was in Berlin, there's a lot of graffiti in the East, and I was kind of reading it in relationship to New York graffiti or Detroit graffiti, and it really isn't. It's much more affirmative, actually. It's kind of post-wall good feelings of, we get to be free and we get to spray paint buildings. It doesn't have the same underclass, connotation. So those are just, and I can think of other examples of graffiti that are coming out of specific cultural moments, and that's really what I think is more interesting. I can imagine graffiti that could be illegal and just isn't doing anything very interesting. That's like, we've seen that 1,000,000,000 times. It's kind of annoying, actually, at this point. But I can think of graffiti. I remember when it really hit in the early 80s. It was like something coming up, that was otherwise repressed or oppressed, and it really had, quite a lot of power. And so between those two poles, right, that, I think it still is, I think you have to maintain a certain kind of demand that the work be doing something,
I'm going to go back to the original question about, who gets to define negative and positive? I too thought it was a wonderful talk and very instructive, and I'm not trying to carp with this question at all.
Yeah.
But what is positive? Positive in your talk seems always to be false positivity. And I know that these concepts shift around in history and according to social positioning and social use. now about graffiti, you could take snapshots of what you said, and there was some graffiti that you said, you know, that's just bad, annoying graffiti, and then there's some really good graffiti, and it, you know, you could recuperate what you said into, you know, some is doing work, some, you know, the good stuff in the 80s that you were valorizing is doing cultural work. It is artistically pleasing. The stuff that's annoying is tired, it's repetitive, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you could just, you know, in your accurate, I would say, analysis of the two kinds of graffiti or your reaction to them, one is, you know, valorized and one is not.
Mm-hmm.
Now I could say, well, is the one positive and the one negative? You know, that's where the terms start to.
If you don't make a judgment of when something is really doing something, and you don't keep that in mind as important, then you're saying that certain kinds of work just do those things by their own nature, and that doesn't make any sense to me. So you'd say graffiti is transformative, but maybe that's not true. Maybe graffiti is simply, you know, a waste of effort.
I guess I'm just pointing out my sense of an ultimate slipperiness of. Really, in a way, the category of the positive of your problem seems ultimately very slippery. So I guess that was my.
Yeah, I think the positive is a concept that could take another amount of time to deal with. But in what I thought was interesting about Hegel, actually, was the ways in which he understood state forms of religion. You know, in authoritarian contexts, right, as the kind of positivity that then concerned him to develop the work of the negative, right? So that, you know, now we might say what kinds of positivity motivated us, artists, writers, cultural workers, to develop the forms of negativity that we practice. And I don't think it's not too hard to find what those kinds of positivity were. You know, they were cultural verities, let's say, of a particular historical period, you know, that we're working within and against. It also strikes me that the work of the negative precisely is to specify what positivity is thus meant. You know, the negative isn't just simply a negative over there. It actually sets up names, creates that its account of the positive, right? That would be the work that it does.
The non-false positive.
Even the non-false positive, right? Yeah. Right.
And so wouldn't that itself mean that this is becoming the positive?
Well, again, the question is, you know, let's say somebody does, like the work you've been showing, right, and it's a gallery, right? At the moment it's in a gallery, right, it's institutionalized, and does that suddenly mean it's simply reduced in its effect? And I guess what I'm arguing is, let's say that its introduction into the gallery context is one aspect of its negativity. And then there's the formal negativity of the work itself. That's at least two. And so we've got a negotiation or a relationship between different forms of the negative. There isn't just one of them. So the notion is that once something gets accepted by a community, it's then, you know, bought into, and, you know, followers of Wolfeyes are simply happy in their positive evaluation of Wolfeyes. They like it, you know. That's trivial. You know, and at the same time, it's a ubiquitous response to the negative. And so I'm trying to show, by making the negative not be simply one moment of opposition that then is turned into community values, that it's working on multiple registers. It's a site of negotiation, and with the neo-Rauch, for instance, a site of reconstruction, or reconfiguring, resignifying, all of those things. And so even in the gallery context, the very negative work that you're showing is still doing the work that it's doing. And it's even doing it because it's shown in the gallery, not, you know, not in spite of the fact that it's shown in the gallery. Yeah.
But that's at this moment. Like, I mean, this is kind of expressed in like a linear idea of present and future and the path from one point to the other. And like, I think that doesn't have much to do with like money or institutions, rather like repetition and how much this is exposed to a culture.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that you know pluralizes again is that, let's say, you know, it's 20 years after a certain kind of work, and you're in some position to reproduce that work or to teach it or to publish a book about it or to mount an exhibition in the gallery. How do you do that? And it seems that there are ways of completely taking whatever oppositional force out of the work. There are ways of taking it out of the work entirely. The Dada show in New York was very difficult to recover the moment of Dada for me, seeing that show at the Museum of Modern Art, just because of the way it was so crowded, it was so poorly hung, and you know, not enough space was given to it, and it wasn't well described in terms of the social context. You didn't have enough performance. The literary was downplayed. There weren't enough, you know, oral sonic resources in the show. But let's say you really wanted to get back and show how radical, you know, an act, let's say Duchamp's urinal was, and you worked hard to reconstitute that. Then I think that's the work of the negative. Is to really show that moment where something happened in that act, and that's just, you know, I think that's kind of a duty, let's say, in the politics of the art, is to is to preserve that the force of the work in important ways, and to work with it. So I think maybe we've come to the end. So, well, thanks a lot.